today. Some champagne calcio for our Golazzo end of season party with my Freddy and the Dreamers. Or what happened the last time the old lady Juve went for a Maverick manager? Hello, everybody, and hello once again. It's been too long, Gabriele Marcotti and James Horncastle.
Hello, James.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, sorry about that pause, listener, because, you know, the season went and finished and some playoffs happened and all sorts of stuff.
We've kind of done what Juventus did, which was take the last 5 weeks of the season off.
Nice.
So,
speak for yourself.
And pretty much everybody in the top half of the table got rid of a manager and started looking for a new one. There's loads for us to talk about. And one story, I guess, has been maybe dominating the coverage. It's been what Juve are going to do now that Max Allegri's not going to be in charge anymore. Maurizio Sarri seems to be the sensible choice, but there's still a kind of renegade part of the media that's insisting...
You mean Twitter?
Yeah. That's insisting on another altogether less credible idea.
Or two less credible ideas. What we do know for certain is that a man named Fali Ramadani, who's an intermediary, has gone and spoken to Chelsea, as has Maurizio Sarri, saying, you know, I'd like to leave because I have an offer from Juventus. And Chelsea are saying, okay, we don't want you to go, but if you go, we're going to want compensation. So we're at the stage at where if you believe the traditional track of what is going on, it's simply a question of Chelsea agreeing compensation with Juventus, and then Maurizio Sarri goes. But it's not hasn't happened yet. Now, again, logically, you say, well, it hasn't happened yet because Andrea Agnelli's been really busy. He had the FIFA Congress and the UEFA meetings in Paris.
He went to Baku as well. I can't remember. Where did he go to Baku?
Because well, he went to Baku not to watch a game.
Right.
He went to Baku for UEFA meetings. He is on the UEFA Expo.
Right.
And he also happened to meet Bruce Buck, the Chelsea chairman, when he was there.
Okay. Nervous times for Pep Guardiola as he waits to hear if he's going to get that opportunity in Turin or not.
Well, wasn't it supposed to happen 2 days ago?
Yeah, it was
he
yesterday.
He was supposed to be announced
it?
And...
Are we going to tell the story now? Or,
well,
because we're kind of on a roll. All right.
All right. If you came for the Gigi Mifredi, stay with us, listener.
Yeah. Because the Gigi Mifredi, the reason we're doing this, it's the obvious parallel with Maurizio Sarri. But so the mainstream media in Italy have reported that Maurizio Sarri is the guy. Fali Ramadani, I'll assume he's not going to listen to this, but has been talking on it continuously about how, yeah, it's going to be Sarri and I've arranged the whole deal. Aren't I clever? But they argue that no. This is all misdirection from
Staggio.
In fact, they're going to get Pep Guardiola. You know,
when you say they, who are they? And what kind of track record do they have in terms of getting predictions right?
So we're talking about, it's a mixture of people on social media, Juventus fan boards, some people who I think you might describe as being on the verges of mainstream media, one of them being this guy named Luca Momblano, who... I gotta say, I'd never heard of this guy until like a year ago. But
no, me neither. I bumped into him in Villa Perosa. We did a YouTube kind of clip together.
Okay.
Yeah,
he's a regular on a lot of like local radio stations. Now he's the first guy a year ago to have said, "Oh, Cristiano Ronaldo could come to Juventus," and then of course he did. And he was also the first guy to say Allegri will definitely be gone. You know, at a time when Andrea Agnelli was saying, no, 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 the cycle continues. Look, we're really, really young still. So he has a lot of credibility with a certain group of Juventus supporters. Pep's wife was in Italy, and we know this because she documented it on Instagram. Now, there's a story that she went to this leasing company in Turin and leased, was it a Maserati Ghibli? The story is that she went and she leased this car for a year in Turin. So then why would she possibly be doing that, you know? I don't know, but we don't know for certain that it was her, right? These are just things that, and then all sorts of sightings. And,
okay.
You know, they said Pep Guardiola was in this hotel called Principe di Piemonte, which is in Turin.
Which is in a state of reconstruction at the moment.
Yeah, you know, maybe he's hiding in the scaffolding, right?
So Pep Guardiola's not going to Juventus.
Well, but this is where the story gets more interesting, right? Every member of mainstream media has gone out and they've checked the story. They've had Pep Guardiola's brother, Pere Guardiola, who's his agent, come out, strongly deny it. There's this Italian dude who's the head of Piaggio, the guys who make scooters, who's on the board of Manchester City, who came out and strongly deny it. There's no logical reason why Pep Guardiola, frankly, would leave. except then you get into two other bits of the conspiracy. The first one is that Italian tax law is changing. So to reattract Italian talent from abroad.
You could go, James.
Yes, you could go.
Right.
People who've been taxpayers in Italy and go abroad for X amount of time and come back.
It has to be
back.
2 years, no?
2 years what?
You have to be outside the country
two years.
Yeah, two or more years. And then come back and they meet certain requirements. They're only taxed on 30% of their salary. And
if you Pep doesn't strike me as a man who's overly concerned about
It certainly helps Juventus pay for him, right? Because obviously Pep was an Italian taxpayer back when he played for Roma and Brescia. The other element to this, and here we get into this wonderful Italian word called dietrologia, right, which is the conspiracy theory where there's always something behind it.
The game behind the game.
Yeah, essentially, and it is a wonderful word. Ology is the study of, and dietro means behind, so it's behind ology, basically.
So the argument is this. Manchester City, as you know, have been referred to the adjudicatory chamber of UEFA's club financial control body over... Right. Violations of financial fair play requirements
in
the,
James.
Between 2011 and 2014. I know. I try to make it sound as boring as I can. So people look, Andrea Agnelli is on the UEFA executive committee. Another Italian guy, Michele Uva, who all of a sudden he's presented in the media as like Agnelli's mate. He's a UEFA vice president and he oversees the EXCO committee that writes the financial fair play regulations. Aha. So the plan is Agnelli and Uva chuck Manchester City out of Europe. And so Pep has a clause in his contract with City where he supposedly can leave if they don't qualify for Europe. And then look, we're out of Europe. And so he's free to go and join Juventus without compensation.
But when would that decision come through?
This is one of the factors that makes it absurd. I mean, leaving aside the fact that if the clause is there and qualify for Europe, obviously did qualify for Europe, whether they're allowed to play or not has to do with a whole bunch of other factors. But Manchester City still have to receive the judgment. As we tape this, it's June 6th. They still haven't come out with a decision. When they do come out for a decision, City will have the opportunity to go and appeal to CAS, the Court of Arbitration for Sport. All these things put together strongly suggest to me that this is all abject nonsense. The timing isn't there. Even if City are banned, it's not going to be before next season. But this story has taken on a life of its own, and it really is.
Because it's Pep.
And Juventus' share price keeps climbing and climbing and climbing, which, Gab, begs the question, if you're putting this story out there, you can get into some bother, no?
This is a great point. There's always been something weird with Juventus' share price. If you look at the volume of trading of Juventus, in terms of, so the number of people buy and sell Juve shares every day, relative to other listed clubs, like, say, Manchester United or Borussia Dortmund, is absolutely enormous. For whatever reasons, Juve's share price gets day traded more than any other. Now, the fact that you get day traded, first of all, let's make it very clear, right? It doesn't really benefit Juve in any way. But it does suggest that there's a lot of people out there who say, oh, look, the price is very sensitive to news. And, you know, maybe I can dip in and out and make some money. So one of the conspiracies is that there's people out there who are fueling this, who have bought a bunch of Juve shares, want to sell them at their peak, and then maybe short the price when it starts falling again, when Pep doesn't come. I honestly don't know, but what's happened is people on the web have become incredibly aggressive and incredibly harassing of the mainstream media, simply because the mainstream media is sticking with the Sarri story. I don't think Sarri is a great fit for Juventus, and I think they will take him, but I think Sarri is a plan B. I think their plan A is a different manager in the Premier League with a big contract. I think that manager is Pochettino. I think the reason Sarri hasn't been announced yet is they wanted to wait until after the Champions League final to take a strong, hard run at Pochettino. Obviously, Pochettino would be very expensive too and difficult to get out of Spurs and all this other jazz. But I think it suits Juve just fine that people are talking Sarri Guardiola. We'll see whether they get Poch or not. I think that is their plan. I could be totally wrong.
Well, that's fascinating. You mentioned the fact that Sarri, who's the probable replacement for Allegri, is not... He'd be a departure from the usual steely Juventus, no? The Juventus style.
Yeah, without doubt. Their motto is winning isn't important, it's the only thing that counts. How you do it doesn't matter to Juventus.
It's a long motto. How do they remember all that?
But it does all of a sudden seem to matter to Juve. They obviously felt there were limitations to Massimiliano Allegri's style. What I would say in terms of fit, if you look at everything that Juventus have done the last couple of years, they've tried to really rebrand the entire club.
Literally.
Be it the logo, be it next year's kit. And I think, you know, in terms of the manager as well, that all kind of folds into it as well. However, I do think it is not the most natural fit, not only because of Sarri's past, you know, working for Napoli, but in terms of also he's a tracksuit manager, a very kind of establishment club.
Very sloppy.
You think about how many people you have to keep happy at Juventus, and this is a guy who basically picks 11 players, plays 11 players. I think that's going to put a few noses out of joint as well. I mean, are you really going to be doing what Rafa Benitez did to Cristiano Ronaldo and telling him how to play a different way? Or
that's the obvious elephant in the room. It's not a good match with the players. You'd have to play Cristiano at center forward, which he may or may not really want to do. And also, you have all these old players. Like, this is the... You know, people don't realize how old this Juve team really is. And these are old players who've won things, right? Who are established players. It's harder, I think, to go and start teaching people like that. And in that sense, Pochettino makes a lot more sense because he can be more pragmatic. And Pep, hypothetically, would make more sense because obviously Pep is Pep. He has a level of charisma.
Whenever Pep goes anywhere, you have to lay a lot of groundwork. You have to commit to spending a lot of money to basically shaping the team as he would like it. And I look at Juventus and at the moment, yeah, okay, let's talk about Pogba, let's talk about Milinkovic, but you look at how much money they've invested in Cristiano in fee, wages, you look at that wage, but at the moment, I don't know how they do it unless they have like a fire sale of Cancelo, Dybala, Douglas Costa, blah, blah, blah.
This is a team that has a window of opportunity to win the Champions League. That window of opportunity is now, right? Everything has been built towards that. That was the logic with Allegri, that was the logic with signing Cristiano, whatever. You get another 3 years of Cristiano. But if you bring these other guys in, these guys are project managers. These are guys are managers who you go in a completely different direction philosophically. It's going to take time. And Cristiano doesn't have time. He wants to win now. So I think that's another big factor to consider.
Well, big question marks then over exactly who will be taking over from Max Allegri. But with the likely advent of Maurizio Sarri to the panchina at Juve, we are today taking a look back at the last time the old lady took a massive punt on a pretty unconventional manager. Ow. Ow. Yep, it's the summer of 1990. Great times, people have hair. Italy have just had a World Cup. And Italy's grandest, most august footballing institution has decided to get down with the kids. Out goes grey old Dino Zoff. In comes former champagne salesman and good time Charlie, Gigi Myfredi, a name that would soon become a kind of cautionary tale that managers would scare their club presidents with. A lot of this is to do with the fact that Arrigo Sacchi was wowing everybody down the road at Milan. To what extent is Gigi Myfredi a kind of John the Baptist to Arrigo Sacchi's messiah?
In Italy and Germany at the time, everybody played with a sweeper and two markers, right? And that's what made Sacchi so revolutionary. Gigi Myfredi also played a straight zone, like Sacchi. But one big difference was, whereas Sacchi had very athletic players who would, very skillful players, but guys who would go and press the opposition and win the ball high up the pitch and stuff like that. They'd do it intermittently, but it was very effective when they did. Myfredi's teams didn't. So they just kind of had a back four that tried to catch you offsides. And then you had all these guys up the pitch who were just kind of standing around waiting for the ball. And that was one sort of problem. He crammed a lot of attacking players. He wanted to commit people forward.
Four across the front. No, a front line of four players often. Huh?
Yeah, the idea was if you've got four guys up there, then the other team has to hold their fullbacks back, right? Because you don't want to be in a one-on-one situation under man, plus one, often two defensive midfielders, because this is still Italy at the time, right? So other teams would freak out and be like, whoa, you know, there's four guys attacking us. Well, we better defend with a goalkeeper and six guys, and then you three guys at the other end, you guys deal with it. And that's what made it very effective.
And it was effective because he'd risen up. His backstory is it's very unconventional. The comparison with Maurizio Sarri is in the fact that he starts out with these unheard-of regional teams and rises until he gets his big break.
Yeah, it's quite a fascinating story in that he was in the youth setup at Brescia. He's from a little village around 20 kilometres outside of Brescia. And if you listen to him speak, actually, and close your eyes, you'll hear that accent, which is the same accent as Mario Balotelli.
A casa fa, signora, sono Boniperti. E siccome io ho degli amici che facevano queste scale, fa, sì, va bene, io sono Charlestone, metto giù, no?
Vabbè.
E questo dopo un po' richiama, fa: guardi signora che io sono Boniperti, ah mi scusi, insomma.
Such a distinctive regional accent.
Mm. And 3 days apparently before he's due to make his first team debut for Brescia, he does his knee and that's it, done. And one of the kind of strange things that he does is he starts coaching these kind of regional teams. He goes and becomes the assistant down at Crotone with Oronzo Pugliese. And then he comes back and he decides, you know what, I'm going to found my own team, be president of my own team and coach that team. And it's called Real Brescia.
Don't look for it. It's not there anymore.
It's not there anymore. But I did not know how interlinked his career was with that of Corioni.
Yeah.
Now, Corioni was the president of Ospitaletto, which is this little club that he gets into the, was it the fourth division or third division? Again, you probably haven't heard of it. Corioni seems to want to invest in football and goes on to bigger and better things, and he takes charge of Bologna, and he thinks, I'm going to bring my Freddy with me. And this is the thing about Bologna at the time, they're in the second division. People probably don't realise what hard times Bologna fell on in the 80s, because after what, giving Roberto Mancini his debut at the beginning of that decade, they go down again, Leeds United style, to the third division. They come up, but they can't get back into the top flight until Gigi Maifredi comes with Corioni and his, well, he brings his champagne football with him.
Yeah, he brings a bunch of players. The Bologna fans are not overwhelmed by this, not least because he's never managed above the fourth division before. They lose their opening game. They don't lose again all season and go up to Serie A. The first season up in Serie A, his second season in charge, they stay up. The third season, they get into the UEFA Cup. It is extraordinarily successful. And there are emotional scenes when, at the end of that campaign, having received a phone call from Giampiero Boniperti, the man in charge of Juve, he's decided to take his big chance and take over at Juve. But there's floods of tears at the Dallara and all this. I mean, incredible success. Whatever happened after, and boy, did a lot of things happen after, he was hugely successful. Isn't it true? I know you've hung out with Carlo Ancelotti a lot. But Arrigo Sacchi, who's regarded as the prophet, the guy who revolutionised Italian football, supposedly
stole all his ideas?
Yeah, stole all his ideas from Maifredi. Apparently he watched tapes of Bologna. And in Preferisco la Coppa, the Ancelotti book, he quotes Sacchi saying, ragazzi, dovete cercare di imitare Bologna di Maifredi, è la squadra più bella che esista. Which, I don't know if that's true, but it's kind of remarkable that this guy was doing Sacchi before Sacchi.
What's even more remarkable is, if you know Arrigo Sacchi and you listen to him now, the fact that he would ever say somebody else's team was better than his yeah. or more impressive than his.
He'll give it to Pep.
The story coincides to a point. Remember, 87, 88 was the year that they were promoted from Serie B to Serie A. That was also the year that Arrigo Sacchi won his first title with Milan.
Right.
So I buy that to a point.
He makes this point that he was in the same class at Coverciano with Sacchi, with Zenit Zeman, and that the guys who were real revolutionaries were the guys you probably never hear of anymore, which is Maifredi and right. Zeman. And that
Gaglione?
Sacchi, well, Gaglione as well, but Sacchi essentially just like looked at what they were doing, took the best bits, because again, Maifredi's saying this, there's a lot of self-interest here, but he was like, Sacchi, before he saw my teams, he played with a libero, he played with a back three. It was only after he like saw what me and Zenek were doing that he thought, yeah, I'll take the best of what the Czech guy is doing, I'll take the best of what Maifredi is doing, I'll mix it all together and create this great synthesis. He's always asked, you know, are you the real revolutionary in Italian football? And what does he say? He says, yes, I am. Often in the third person. Yes, Maifredi is.
The modest man.
Right. So spring 1990, you've got the World Cup looming and a real facelift for all of Italian football that goes with it. You've got Sacchi doing incredible things at Milan, and everybody's thinking we need a bit of this ourselves. Inter go for a Zona Pura manager of their own in Corrado Orrico, who's completely vanished from...
Yeah. Well, he's on TV a lot in Italy,
okay,
and he's kind of hilarious.
But Boniperti calls up Maifredi and prepares this revolution. Dino Zoff, who that season would bring home a double with the Coppa Italia and the UEFA Cup as well, is told to make way.
One of the remarkable things, I mean, you said Giampiero Boniperti called him, and he may have, but one of the key figures here is another guy. It is Luca Cordero di Montezemolo, who is this extremely posh, blue-blooded. You know how, like, you guys love making fun of poor Jacob Rees-Mogg and the way he talks? Like, he talks the same. He's kind of, like, cut from the same cloth, only he's Italian. And
he's very dashing as well, Montezemolo.
He is probably, yes. I think he's equally rail-thin, but he's a lot better dressed, and he's a lot more handsome than Jacob.
He, at the time, was busy preparing. He was in charge of, essentially, Italia 90.
There's this YouTube video of, I can't remember what TV show it is, but basically it's three journalists having dinner with someone from football. And my Freddy's the guest this time. And he tells this story about being invited to the Germany-England game, semi-final in Turin, along with Claudio Gentile and Marco Tardelli. They were part of this Coverciano kind of study group to study different nations in football, and they'd been allocated Germany. Anyway, Montezemolo tells him, come to the Delle Alpi, you can watch the game with us, and invites him into the box that he's in. And he's there with Boniperti, but he's also there with Henry Kissinger, the president of Mercedes, the president of Fiat in Argentina. And the official language in that box is English. He doesn't speak a word of English. The only English he knows is corner, blue jeans, and teddy boys, apparently. And it's only when Gianni Agnelli's secretary basically says, do you not speak English? Do you want to speak Italian? That he's like, oh, thank God, someone's here. You've saved me. And then after the game, there's helicopters, bizarrely, from Delle Alpi to Caselle, the airport in Turin. They're all going to fly away to wherever they're going. And that's when he has this final meeting to discuss his contract with Juventus, with Agnelli, Cesare Romiti, and Montezemolo. And they said, look, it's a three-year deal. And as always happens with Juventus, with Boniperti and Agnelli, you don't discuss how much you're going to get paid. You're just grateful for the opportunity. And he says, well, I only sign one-year deals. Because, ultimately, if it's good, we'll extend. If it goes bad, I'll go. And Agnelli apparently turned to him and said, so you're the kind of captain that would abandon the ship if it all goes wrong, would you? This is maybe his first mistake.
Yeah.
This is such an Agnelli kind of mind smock move, isn't it?
So Juve were busy making some changes. The switch from Boniperti to Montezemolo, who wasn't even based in Turin. I think he was based down in Rome, and had a bunch of other things happening. You also had the club breaking the bank to bring in, for what I think was a world transfer record, Roberto Baggio, which gave them a pretty impressive pool of talent up front. You had Salvatore Schillaci, Toto Schillaci, who just...
top goal scorer at the World Cup.
There you go. Baggio now... Gigi Casiraghi.
The Prince.
And a young man from the outskirts of Rome who embodied...
Cholo.
Who embodied lo stile Juve, Paolo Di Canio. And my Freddy basically goes, brilliant, we'll put them all on the field together.
Not just that, but together with a Smurf-sized dribbling
machine.
Thomasino
Hessler.
Thomas Hessler, freshly crowned
Thomasino
world champion.
Hessler.
Yeah, I mean, it was such a top-heavy team that it wasn't even funny. And they were like, oh, but that's okay, because at the back... So he takes with him from Bologna two guys who are super likable people. One is a fullback named Gianluca Lupi, and the other one is the legendary Marco De Marchi, of course, who would go on a globe-trotting adventure, which ultimately would take him to exotic places in Greece and Dundee as well.
It wasn't the kind of classic defence, certainly, when you look at that squad. It wasn't... They had Julio Cesar there, and Tacconi in goal, but it maybe wasn't the greatest defence they've ever had, and particularly with the kind of football he liked to play, that might prove to be a problem, because having come from the most beautiful team that had ever existed, in Sacchi's words, at Bologna, this was to prove the biggest disaster in Juve history. He began with an Italian Super Cup against Napoli.
Oh. Andrea Silenzi
with
was
Andrea Silenzi.
The line for Napoli. So they get beaten 5-1. And I had this distinct memory as a kid about, I think Silenzi scored two goals in that game. I don't know how many Nottingham Forest fans listen to this podcast, but they may recall Andrea Silenzi for what he was. And he was basically a big guy who couldn't really play. And just
former Italian international.
Yeah, of probably like the three cat variety. But I just remember him. He's like babbling like a kid. And he kept repeating like, I scored 2 goals against Juventus and I scored them with my feet. Look at this.
We should say that Napoli that year, they were champions.
Right. And they also had Maradona and Ciro Ferrara.
Well, this is the year when, this is Gianfranco Zola's breakout year.
Ah, nice, yeah.
Because obviously Diego is having some issues. More on that, go watch Asif Kapadia's documentary, which is out soon. But they put in one of the worst title defences, I would say, that you could...
A curiously bad title defence.
They finished 8th in 91. So to lose 5-1 to that side, not a great look.
Mm. Indeed not. And that wasn't the only not good look that was to follow in weeks to come. They exited the Coppa Italia, the competition they'd won, to Taranto on the 12th of September, losing 2-1. And there's a video of my Freddy. It's not great quality. I mean, as you can hear for yourselves, it's him basically berating the team at halftime when I think the scoreline's still 1-1. And then you got the scenes at full time when the players fired up by his halftime instructions have gone out and lost the second half and got knocked out of the competition. And the bizarre thing about it is he's ranting and kind of punching bits of furniture. And the players are just wandering around going about their business, much like he looks like a friend of the owner who's wandered in by accident.
He's pacing the dressing room with his inner suit, hands in his pockets, just listing off those kind of Italian insults that all begin with uncle. Yeah, and it doesn't seem to get any kind of reaction at all from the players.
There were some good results, though, and some very good results in that first half of his only season at Juve. They beat Inter 4-2.
Would won the title, of course, 2 years previously.
They beat Roma, who were a solid side, 5-0.
Yes, Gilacci got a hat-trick, I think.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. And they end the first half of the season in second place, only 2 points off the top. However, the second half of the season, they just blew up. They went 10 games without a win. They end up in seventh place until certainly Calciopoli. It was the worst season that Juve had ever had.
28 years. First time in 28 years that they didn't qualify for a European competition.
We should mention in here the 6th of April, the Fiorentina game, where they travelled to Florence. And, of course, it's the first time that Roberto Baggio's been back to the Artemio Franchi, and the fans prepare this kind of emotional choreography of the skyline there under the curve of Fiesole, and emotional scenes as Juve get a penalty. Baggio refuses to take it against his old club.
Col sinistro, Mareggini in calcio d'angolo. Clamoroso dopo il rifiuto di Roby Baggio, sbaglia De Agostini.
He's subbed off by my Freddy, and as he makes this kind of lap of honour on his way, he kind of has to do it to get to where the entrance was in those days to the dressing rooms. Somebody throws this Fiorentina scarf, and I mean the story is famous. He picks it up and leaves the field with it.
Abbandona il campo Roberto Baggio. A Roby Baggio arriva una sciarpa della Fiorentina dalla curva viola, la raccoglie e se ne va con quella.
And my Freddy afterwards basically gives him full support, says, no, I respect Baggio as a man for what he's done. And when you look at why things fell apart, I mean, that dressing room scene certainly speaks to this notion that the players could not bear him. There's also a theory, I mean, beyond the tactical imbalances of his approach, that he was so in love with Baggio that the rest of the squad just...
Yeah, this is covered. There's an excellent bit on this in Paolo Di Canio's book where he talks about, you know, arriving in Turin, and then Baggio's there, and all of a sudden, everything is about Baggio. And when the screws started to turn, even Maifredi, for all his orthodoxy and everything, he kind of realized, like, this isn't going to work. Either our attacking players start working harder, or I need to put out a better balanced team than this insanity that I've been doing. Nobody's spared from having to work harder, except for Roberto Baggio. And that's when some players, including, you know, as you know, Paolo takes things very well. So, you know,
he and Baggio probably got on really well, I'm thinking. Two more similar
characters. No, and he said, like, you know, they do these drills. You'd get the attacking players to do these drills where basically, because they weren't quite pressing, but they were just off the ball. He asked them to defend a little bit deeper and try to challenge attack, especially it was attacking fullbacks one-on-one. So, you know, you'd get Gigi Casiraghi sort of lumbering over to try to do it. You get little Thomas Hessler, you get Paolo. And Baggio was like, no. Baggio was like, stick out a leg, and the guy would just run past him. He's like, I don't I don't do that, you know. And it would be just, oh, that's fine, that's fine. That sent a bad vibe throughout the team. There's also a period that season when, I think it might have been around the Fiorentina game, when Baggio was clearly depressed and not right in the head. When, you know, some players went to Mike Fredi and says, like, look, why don't you just give him a week off or whatever? And he's like, no. Like, you know, and I don't think he had the personality to lead this team. I think he felt, honestly, as if I'm so fortunate to be here that I better do exactly what I think the club wants me to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because I think you see these guys who do special things with provincial clubs. They get their first shot in the big time. And when Gab was saying that, it immediately brought to mind Giampiero Gasperini when he went to Inter. Okay, Inter team that is...
That was a zoo, though.
I mean. Yeah, a zoo, but a kind of team at the end of the cycle. But a guy who initially goes in there and sort of is walking on eggshells, trying to keep everybody happy, and they don't respond to his ideas, and he's out within, what, 3 weeks. And it's interesting that Gasperini has been able to rebuild his career, even after, what, the first two or three jobs after that were a disaster for him, whereas Manfredi never was. And you're right, James, in pointing out his relationship with Baggio, because in many ways it did define him, and he allowed it to define him, because when it's often brought up that, Gigi, you know, your team's played excellent football, you won the fourth division, you won the second division, but you didn't really win anything else significant. And he just turns around and says, yeah, but I did get to coach Roberto Baggio for a year.
Well, at the end of that season, it is decided that he will leave, although, as he points out, he wasn't fired. Whether he decides to abandon a sinking ship or whatever, it was completely untenable, the position with the players, for whatever reason, he departs, and Juve decide to go with another revolutionary free thinker, young Giovanni Trapattoni, who comes in.
I mean, it is interesting the defence that Manfredi puts up about that year at Juventus. And it sounds a little naive, because he says it was a transition year. It's like, well, there are no transition years at Juventus. You have to win. Mm. We brought up the motto that they have earlier. And, you know, he says, look, they hadn't won for a few years before me. It took them a while to win again. It wasn't until what Lippi came in that they were able to do that. It was, what, 9 years in total. So it clearly, yeah, I made mistakes, but it wasn't all the manager's fault.
Absolutely. And when you look at his career before that, he'd had extraordinary success, which led to him getting offered that job. The thing that really is hard to argue against is what happened to him in every single job he's done since then. So the next season, he goes back to Bologna, where he'd been such a success, but is swiftly fired. That's the 91-92 season. So then he goes to Genoa in 92-93, hired and fired. In 94-95, he's hired and fired by Venezia and then Brescia, after having 7 games in charge and losing all of them. That's Pescara, same thing in the following season. By 1997, he's in Tunisia. It doesn't work out there. Then he joins Albacete.
He's coaching Esperance, which is one of the super clubs, to be fair. But even then, he manages to screw it up.
Okay, then he's at Albacete in Spain. And by the new millennium, he's in Serie C1 with Reggiana. He gets fired there too. Becomes technical director at Brescia. Has a brief stint of, let me see, 7 days, is it? On the bench at Brescia after Giampaolo was fired by them. This is in Serie B. Yeah, he loses, and they replace him with Cristiano Bergodi, Gazza's former teammate at Lazio. Interesting. I mean, last I'd kind of been aware of him in kind of footballing circles was he had a team of players who would reenact goals on the Italian equivalent of Sky Soccer Saturday, Quelli che il Calcio. You know, they couldn't show the goals, so they'd get his mob to enact them. But I think he's doing punditry and stuff now, is he?
No, not anymore. He was a kind of post-match analyst, and there's a famous kind of tete-a-tete argument
with Ciro Ferrara.
Manfredi, again, kind of gives this impression of being this sort of misunderstood genius who's very happy to criticise from his ivory tower, and Ciro Ferrara is having absolutely none of it. You go back to selling champagne.
We never explained that. After his meniscus had ruptured, he had a stint working for Veuve Clicquot as a kind of a travelling salesman.
Yeah. I mean, again, this fits in with the Sacchi shoe salesman, Malisani, you know, working for Canon.
Copiers.
Yeah.
Nice. Let's just finish off here with a nice quote here from Gigi Manfredi. I and Zdenek Zeman, Zdenko, we're the real Zona Champagne. The others are only derivatives, including Sacchi. Arrigo used to play with five at the back. It was Berlusconi who told him to pass to a 4-4-2. He's convinced that the outstanding player must adapt himself to the blueprint of the manager. I, on the other hand, have always thought the contrary. Just ask my Badjo.
You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Hey everybody, we're back in colour in the present day. So much has happened since our last Galazzo. Juve, the champions, Napoli, Atalanta and Inter are joining them in the Champions League next season. Into the Europa League go Milan, Roma and Lazio as the Coppa Italia winners, beating Atalanta. Down go Empoli with Frosinone and, I'm sorry, Gab, Chievo. And make it even worse for Chievo. This is just rotten. It's the fact that Verona, their friends across the city, have come up, along with Brescia and Lecce. That's the lineup for next season. Five of the top eight sides last season have changed managers. We've talked about the confusion at Juve. We do know who's going to be the new manager for the Nerazzurri at Inter, and that is, James?
Antonio Conte.
Are we going to have a proper title race next season?
Well, Conte comes to win, ultimately. You know, he did that at Siena, he did that at Bari, he did it at Juventus, he did it at Chelsea. He's pretty much won wherever he's been, apart from Atalanta.
Apart from Bergamo, where he's hounded out of town.
Cristiano Doni.
After 6 days. Not a good cultural fit.
And you can tell they're recruiting for a win-now team because Gab thinks Juventus are old, but wait until you see Diego Godin and Edin Dzeko playing for Inter. Yeah, it's clear that
Nicolò Barella is likely to be joining them, though. He's a youngster.
Yeah, but
you just know that they're going to screw that up. You just know that Barella's not going to come, and they'll end up with like the older, injured version of Barella. They'll just, you know, pick up Montolivo on a free or some nonsense like that. I don't know. I
don't understand why Inter have like three guys. You've got Marotta, who's the chief executive on the sports side of the business. You've then got your friend Pier Ausilio, Gab. And then you've got Pier Ausilio's little man, Bacin. It's like, why do you need all these dudes?
Gab, what do you think about Inter and their prospects?
I think Conte is a phenomenal manager. I'm not sure about when you've just come out of a financial fair play regimen. I'm not sure about all the spending on veterans and older players and the big wage bill. Obviously, I'd love the Barella signing if they can get it done.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems to me like this is not a team that's well run in terms of foresight.
Lukaku had been linked with them repeatedly. There's a lot of confusion about where he might be going. You're saying no. Napoli.
I don't know. You're not going to get Dzeko and Lukaku? I mean, what?
They want Lukaku.
Inter do.
Yeah.
And Napoli as well.
Told that Inter definitely want Lukaku.
Okay.
It's just a case of valuation.
But it's one of those stupid things where they're like, oh yeah, we want Lukaku. And look, they want Perisic. You know, let's do a straight up spot. Yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. You know, like when Lukaku makes twice as much as Perisic and is 4 years younger, and I don't know, let's just go and replace one inconsistent malcontent for one who makes a lot more money. You know, I don't know, I'm very skeptical.
All right, speaking of expensive malcontents, Paul Pogba, is he going to be returning to Turin?
Well, he was in Turin, a couple of weeks ago.
Did he hire any Maseratis?
No.
For a whole year.
He was at Andrea Bazzelli's goodbye do. But look, I think it's fairly evident that Pogba wants out at Manchester United. Yeah, I mean, it's very clear what Juventus want next season in terms of the midfield player. They've already got Aaron Ramsey, but the two players that they've apparently had talks with are Sergej Milinkovic-Savic, the reigning midfielder of the year after such a phenomenal season for Lazio, and Pogba.
Milan are going to have Gianpaolo. Is that confirmed yet?
It's not confirmed, but it's an appointment that I'd like.
Okay, so he'll be coming in from Sampdoria, Roma.
He's a big Inter fan as well.
And he's Mr. Charisma, isn't he?
Poor chap. I mean, it's an interesting appointment.
Yeah, look, we don't even know. I mean, Milan have, as you know, the sentence came just yesterday from UEFA. They've got serious financial fair play issues. They decided, well, we're not going to look at the three seasons up until 2018, which is where the real problem is,
because right,
that's when the snake oil salesmen were there, until the 2017 issue gets sorted out, and that's with Cass. Fair enough, let's just keep delaying, but this is a team that also probably lost about 80 million this year as well because they made investments. I have no idea where they're going. They said, you know, we'll be smart. We'll get young players and build them up and grow together. It's going to take a Herculean effort to undo all the damage that was done.
Okay, Roma, meanwhile,
they've been screwed over by UEFA and that judgment, because essentially it means that they're going to have to not go on tour in the US, come back early for Europa League and play, what, 3 qualifiers just to get into the group stages. So
yeah, unless...
Because they were hoping Milan would be kind of thrown out of Europe.
And they could move up.
They could move into the group stages.
They are yet to secure their manager. Paolo Fonseca of Shakhtar Donetsk is the likely man to take over from, interim boss Claudio Ranieri.
And De Zerbi is the alternative. I think both are really, really talented managers. Mm. What you don't know is how do they fit into the Roma cauldron? They're getting a new director of football as well. Massara's leaving, right?
Yeah, so Massara's resigned. They've lined up Petrachi for a long time. Petrachi was apparently in Madrid yesterday, but he's still on the contract with Torino, which I don't think they were too pleased that he was in Madrid doing this deal for Fonseca. So yeah, he has to get out of his contract. A lot of people have to get out of their contracts.
I see. Now, when I mentioned the teams coming up next season, Brescia, Lecce and Verona, you'll have noticed that Palermo was not among them, despite the fact that they had seemed set to come up. Since we last spoke about Palermo, well, a lot has happened. And there was the David Platt involving consortium. Then there was another consortium that was coming in, I think, of American investors. And then I guess my guess would be what happened was that somebody actually did the due diligence on the books and found that they were full of very wrong things, and the Italian Federation ended up busting Palermo down to the third division for financial irregularities, for essentially having lied about their finances in order to be deemed capable of performing, you know, of being there for a season.
When have we heard that before?
Yeah. Which is, again, surprising that they managed to get a license every year for the last 2 or 3 years, which is when all these supposed irregularities were going on.
They have an appeal, I think, lodged.
They haven't been relegated. Now, so they were relegated to the third division. They've got that thrown out. They've been given a 20-point penalty.
Oh, right. Okay. So they haven't been relegated?
No.
Okay. But they'll start minus 20.
They might be again, James. I don't know. But at the moment...
They're in Serie B, minus 20 for the new season.
Well, I actually think it was minus 20 and that points total has been levied against this year, which, again, just is pretty mind-boggling.
So that would be...
So, like, if you look at this season's Serie B table, you'll find that Palermo are down in 11th with 43 points, which obviously wasn't where they finished.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm guessing that penalty has already been... levy, okay. Which is surprising. But
and they're still in the hands of Zamperini.
I don't know who owns Palermo, right. James. I don't think Zamperini knows.
All right, well, let's finish off on something which is a little bit more uplifting, and that is the news that after a long time, I'm trying to think how long it's been now, it's what, is it 2 decades or 15 years or something that the Della Valle's been in charge of Fiorentina?
17 years, yeah.
17 years. Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? Wow. And they've been through some times themselves. They've made some mistakes, but they've also done some good things.
Yeah, like Andrea restore and the Colosseum and stuff like that.
They are selling La Viola to a friend of yours, Gab. Rocco Commisso.
A friend of mine, I mean, somebody I've spoken to.
All right. So he's tell us about Rocco Commisso.
So Rocco, is he from Calabria?
Calabria, yeah.
So like all people from the south of Italy, he's a Juventus fan. But he emigrated to the U.S. I mean, it's one of those incredible immigrant stories. Emigrated to the U.S. when he was very, very young. Couldn't speak the language. Went to Columbia University in New York City on a full scholarship.
On a football scholarship, I think.
No,
I believe he was...
No, that is a lie.
Who is it?
Look, honestly, the amount of nonsense that's been written. I've heard people say, like, oh, look, he's a TV entrepreneur. And he owns a cable company. He lays cables to your house. He's not Mr. Showbiz. Ivy League universities do not offer athletic scholarships.
Oh, no way.
So he did play football at Columbia University and did very, very well.
Right.
To the point that then he paid for the stadium, which is named after him. But no, he got an academic scholarship. He's a super bright guy. Made a bunch of financial sector investments at first, then laid down cables, was very smart about the way he did that. Bought the New York Cosmos, sued MLS to try to get introduce promotion and relegation into the U.S. system. Tried to buy Milan from the snake oil salesman. Obviously, couldn't because the guy didn't really own it, so but whatever, that's a whole other issue. I don't know if it's actually 100% ink dry official, but it's just about done for him to take over Fiorentina. And I think it's a really good thing.
And Fiorentina, they're getting the band back together. It's the Sette Sorelle again.
Well, I thought the Dele Valle's played quite an interesting card, what, the day before the takeover was supposedly concluded by putting out a statement saying, we are not selling Federico Chiesa. Chiesa will be playing for Fiorentina next year. And obviously then the club changes hands. Will that status remain the same with Rocco Commisso? Because it's clear that I think Chiesa has also Fally Ramadani as an intermediary for Fiorentina, agreeing personal terms with Juve.
They laid a big giant pile of turds on Rocco's head because this is their parting gift. Remember when you sold your old flat, James? And before you did that, you defecated on the sofa and in the fridge and
it's
stuff,
the
right?
Gaspoye Brighton.
Exactly.
Sorry, right.
Yeah. So basically, they put him in an impossible position. People know that Rocco is a Juventus fan, right? From childhood. So now, because Chiesa already has a deal in place with Juventus, now he's stuck in the situation where he either gives Chiesa a massive pay rise or somehow goes and like really impresses Fally Ramadani, or even if he sells him for 300 bazillion, to Fiorentina fans, who are not the most rational, will be like, ah, look, the first thing you do when you come here is, you know, you sell kids out of the club you support. You know, it's Agent Rocco who's secretly working for Gianni Agnelli. You know, this will be the narrative.
Well, I look forward to summer of that. And other things too, under the ombrellone. We will reunite soon for more Golazzos.
Will we?
Yeah.
Are we coming back?
Why not? If there's a city I have to talk about, we're there to do that talking. Meantime, many thanks for everything this season again, Gabriele.
My pleasure.
And you, James Horncastle.
Pleasure as well.
And thanks also to producer Charlie. And listener, do enjoy the summer. If you're missing us, go back and listen to all those old Galazzos because they don't really go out of date. In fact, they improve on repeated listening, I find. Anyway, we'll be back at the end of the summer. Until then, from all of us here, it's arrivederci. Campionato di calcio
italiano. You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audioboom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.